Well, the hatchability is an important parameter for the breeder industry, and I basically represent the eggs that successfully hatch. When we look at the last decade in North America, when we looked at in the U.S., we can see there is a decline in hatchability over the years. It's from around, let's see, 10 years ago, from around 84, 85% hatchability for the whole cycle, about 78, 79% currently. So that's a significant decrease in hatchability. And we see a similar pattern in Canada, maybe not as pronounced. So we would say around the same number from 10 years ago, 84, 83%, down to an average 80, maybe 81% in Canada.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. The Poultry Science Association is dedicated to advancing poultry science worldwide. Learn more at poultryscience.org. Anatox, partnering with the world's food producers to develop and deliver innovative programs to efficiently produce safer food. Kemin invites you to optimize poultry health and nutrition. Dive in at kemin.com/poultry. Fortiva, creating ingredients for impact to support animal resilience and health. Learn more at fortivaimpact.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Poultry Nutrition Black Belt podcast, where we discuss the latest in poultry nutrition research and industry trends in approximately 10 minutes. My name is Sam Rochel. I'm a co-host of the show and associate professor of poultry nutrition here at Auburn University. I'm joined today by Dr. Tiago Nitzel, who is currently in Brazil after several years of academic training and positions in Canada, where he's worked in the area of broiler breeders very prolifically. And so he's now working as a consultant in Brazil, and we're going to hear a bit about how he's looked at some of these problems over his career. So, Tiago, great to visit with you today. I'm excited to learn because this is a hot industry topic. So, interested to hear your perspective on kind of the state of the issues around breeders and fertility and hatchability. So really looking forward to it.
All right. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good. So let's just start off from a very high level. You know, what would you say is the current status of hatchability in North America? And I mean, in the rest of the world, you're now back in Brazil. So you've got that perspective too. And you hear these comparisons a lot about North America versus Latin America. And so be interested to hear your take on that.
Yeah, so the hatchability is an important parameter for the breeder industry, and I basically represent the eggs that successfully hatch. When we look at the last decade in North America, when we looked at in the U.S., we can see there is a decline in hatchability over the years. It's from around, let's see, 10 years ago, from around 84, 85% hatchability for the whole cycle, about 78, 79% currently. So that's a significant decrease in hatchability. And we see a similar pattern in Canada, maybe not as pronounced. So we would say around the same number from 10 years ago, 84, 83%, down to an average 80, maybe 81% in Canada. But it's interesting when we look at the rest of the globe, and I'm not as familiar, I would say, in Asia, for example, but I know a little bit in Europe and, of course, in Brazil. We were able to maintain a good hatchability overall, so because of several reasons of that. So we can see that the genetic and some of those areas or some of this region in the world, they're very similar to what we have in North America still. But you can see that some management practices, maybe the facilities, some other things are different here. And that's why we are able to maintain hatchability as recommended when we look at the guidelines, for example, but and sometimes even exceeding them. So we can see that we do have a problem. And you probably have heard that from breeder producers. If you talk all breeder producers, hatchability is one of their concerns when we talk with them.
Kemin calls all poultry experts. You already know the key to a profitable operation is healthy, productive birds. Our team of poultry experts are driven by curiosity to develop science-backed ingredients and solutions that help you maintain feed and water quality, improve intestinal health, optimize nutrition, and eliminate pathogens. Learn more today by diving in at kemin.com/poultry to learn more.
Absolutely. And you mentioned a bit about different management practices. I mean, What do you see from your perspective in different geographic regions? I mean, what do you think the current management practices for breeders are to really support good hatchability numbers?
Yeah, so one of the things that we have for hatchability, so there's different factors that affect, of course. So we can go all the way to handling eggs to incubation, so incubation parameters that we need to look for. But I think probably the most important part that plays on hatchability is egg fertility. So, because all eggs that are infertile, they're not going to hatch. So egg fertility is probably one of the most important ones, and it is likely the one that we see as some problems in North America, at least the producers I've seen there. So we have lots of different practices for that. So to manage egg fertility, and the main one is probably male management. I can talk a little bit about the role of male and female on fertility.
Sure. Yeah.
But basically what we do with male, I think one of the main practices we utilize is adding younger males to the flock, so spiking. So at a certain age, we know the males, they work well at the first half of the cycle. And after 45 weeks of age, or 50 weeks, you usually see a decrease in mating of these older males, decrease in sperm quality. And that's why we usually bring new males to the flock. So, of course, there are a lot more to that, too. So there's other practices, as probably one of the most important ones is uniformity of the flock. And that's probably one of the differences that we see from comparing the South America to North America is that we have this extra labor to be able to control uniformity of the flock and maintain a better hatchability all the way through. When we look at the actual, when we look at the years, the recommendation from the breeders, for example, you can see that the overall average of hatchability that is recommended is fairly similar over the years. But you see a difference that usually there was an increase over the years in the potential for higher hatchability in the first part of the laying cycle, so around 25 weeks up to 40, 45 weeks. But there's actually a decrease in this potential towards the end. So we do see that the genetics has changed and made our life a little harder to control and to get the best we can from those breeders towards the end of the cycle. And that's where the most of the problems, that when you talk to producers, the end of the cycle is their concern regarding hatchability.
As far as this topic around different practices, obviously this is kind of a nutrition oriented podcast, just on the feeding, I know you've talked some about this in the past and precision feeding, you've done a lot of work in that area, but just from a more general standpoint, you know, in the U.S., at least the best I understand, we still have the majority of people aren't feeding their males separately, separate diets, separate nutrition. How is that different in Brazil as far as the prevalence of different male feed versus the female feed? From my understanding, it's more common there, right?
Yes. Yeah. From what I've seen, and I haven't visited the U.S. as much as I wanted to, producers at least, I know there are some areas they still commingle birds. So that means they, at the rearing period, they still have males and females eating together. And that's a practice that I haven't seen that practice in the South America, so it's fairly rare if ever exists. So we do rear them separately with separate diets. So that makes a huge difference in rearing those birds and getting them ready to start the production cycle. So, of course, when we talk about the end of the cycle for the breeders, so after 45 weeks of age, we start having problems with hatchability and fertility, but we definitely have to look back and see how those birds were reared, and that's kind of an important part to take in consideration, yes.
And then even within the breeder house, are most operations that you're familiar with, at least in Brazil or other places, are they feeding the males separate diets?
Yes. The diets also are feeding separate diets. So as we know, requirements change. If we feed the same diet, you can get away with it, but there is a lot more calcium, for example, at the that considering that in the laying cycle, and a lot higher in protein that the males don't need. And the diet also should still have some difference as well. You can also do that in the rearing period, have some different diets. But during the rearing, because birds are not you know, females and males, they're still different, but they're not as different in the laying cycle. You can still get away with the same diet between the rearing period.
Yeah. And just from the precision feeding, can you talk a little bit about that kind of insights from different precision feeding systems?
Yeah. So with the precision feeding, there was a development of precision feeding in University of Alberta. So Martin Zuidoff has done that. And over the years, well, the objective of that system was first to feed females, right? And because we feed females in that system, we also ended up, Dr. Zuidoff ended up feeding males as well. And what he found out in an unwanted way, so that was more of a serendipity, he found that feeding males with the precision feeding system had increased fertility in most of the trials when he compared to the conventional. So most of the times, some of the trials, we actually have specific comparisons, but some of the time we have different trials going on, and we have a conventional system just to, you know, have the industry standard with us. And we always saw that fertility was higher. And we attribute that mainly to maintaining uniformity within the males. So with the precision feeding system, we were able to rear birds and have them at the end of the rearing cycle with 1% CV. Yeah, so basically 100% uniformity. And that made a huge difference. So, you know, and once you start, those birds start in the reproductive period, you see that overweight males, they tend to do very well at the beginning because of their testicle development and everything. But towards the end, usually they have a decrease in sperm quality and also probably a decrease in mating if they're too heavy as well. And the same happens for underweight males. So underweight males, they won't have a good sperm quality and won't develop their testicles very well as well. So they will do sometimes even worse than overweight males.
Yeah.
So through keeping the uniformity, we saw that that made a big difference. And that's, again, that comes back to some of the labor and uniformity control that we have down in South America. So that's something that we found that was very similar. So with this technology, we were able to see an increase in fertility.
Still delegating work to someone who hasn't adapted to AI? You don't need another assistant stuck in 2015. You need a remote AI specialist who can handle inboxes, research, reporting, ops, admin, sales support, and marketing using tools like ChatGPT, Claude, OpenClaw, and automations. Wise VAs connects you with AI-trained Latin talent in your time zone at up to 80% less than a US AI hire. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. And I think you made a good point. Whether you do it through very advanced technology, as you've worked with Dr. Zuidoff on the precision feeding, or just you have a lot of available labor to kind of achieve some of the same goals, ultimately, uniformity is the name of the game. And if you can achieve that, then a lot of these issues are much more manageable. So very interesting. So what's next in terms of research or recommendations from your perspective for improving hatch and fertility?
Yeah, so we've seen, we can try to get other technologies to improve, you know, uniformity, or things that we have seen that the birds over the years, they've increased a little bit in their size. So we do have higher body weight targets. So of course we have to adjust our feeding space. So things like that, we have to always keep in mind. And as we change our genetics too, and probably some nutritional effects too. So on feather quality, for example, over the years, we've seen that lysine level has decreased a lot in the rearing for those birds. But we didn't see much of adjustment in the other amino acids that are important for feather growth. So that has been done recently. So if you look at some of the recommendation from the breeder companies, you see some of adjustments in the other amino acid levels compared to the lysine level. So you can see that that's basically some adjustments for growth of tendons and feather quality, and that ultimately will affect fertility of those birds. So because those birds had to mate later on, and feather quality is important for mating. So that's some of the things that we can see. Another research that is not recent, but a lot of people don't know, is some research that is done by Rick van Imus from the Netherlands. And his recommendation is that we start with a lower amount of males at the beginning of the reproductive cycle as a percentage of the females in the flocks, so around 5-6% or even less than that. And then we increase the percentage of males as we go towards the end, because towards the end is where we actually need more more males, because there's less mating and the sperm quality decrease. So that's something that a lot of producers still don't know, and they are skeptical to use. So they usually start very high and ended up with less males towards the end, which is, from the physiological perspective, is counterintuitive, because the mating, it's very high at the beginning of the reproductive period.
Makes sense. Well, this is a very complex situation. And so I know it's a big problem for the industry as well. So any new perspectives we can have are certainly appreciated by our listeners, I know, Tiago. So thank you for sharing your insights on this topic.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for listening, everyone, to another episode of the Poultry Nutrition Black Belt Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and follow and subscribe on your preferred platforms. And we will catch you on the next one. Thank you.